You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Back to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic Book Blogger. We're here today with Matt Pratt. We've been talking about his book, The Porn Myth, and the porn epidemic we find ourselves in today. Matt, one of the things I like to talk about is, and I touched upon it briefly earlier, this is covered in That Man Is You, which I run a group here in New Oxford, and they talk about what porn actually does to a person. It actually has the same effect as a drug, doesn't it?
Yeah, so here's why that's true. You know, first we should perhaps respond to the common objection or perhaps thought. You know, someone might say, look, porn isn't a drug because you don't, look, no one's injecting it into themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not inhaling it. So to say that it's a drug is to sort of trivialize real addictions. And that sort of analysis, I think, it shows that one really isn't up to date on modern neuroscience. But when you actually talk to modern neuroscientists who study this stuff, or when you read, for example, what the American ASAM, American Society of Addiction Medicine have to say, you realize that one doesn't have to be, you know, snorting or injecting something for it to negatively impact the brain. Because the fact is, behaviors do elicit neurotransmitters in the brain, which the brain can become addicted to. And neurotransmitter is just a fancy way of saying brain drug. And the reason we call them brain drugs is precisely because they are drugs. Mm-hmm. So just two examples, right? Like let's think of two things that are released, epinephrine and dopamine, okay? Epinephrine is on the, you know, crash cart in any emergency room, and it's used to start the heart up again if it stops, or to help it beat faster. So, okay, is it only a drug if it's in a syringe, but not if my brain creates the exact same thing? Obviously not, right? A drug is a drug. Or if you think dopamine, if you know someone with Parkinson's disease, if they're on medication, they're taking a derivative of dopamine. So is it only a drug if it's in the form of a pill? Obviously not. Well, these neurotransmitters or brain drugs are released, you know, as well as others, when one has a pornographic encounter. Now, dopamine is important to talk about because it plays a key role in pleasure reward behaviors. Mm-hmm. It's what incentivizes us to do things that are, you know, good for us and good for the survival of our species, you know. So without dopamine, in addition to not being able to move, because you'd have Parkinson's disease, you wouldn't be as incentivized to, you know, play a game or win a game or eat a hamburger when you were hungry or have sex, you know. Like, without dopamine, sex would be like chewing gum, you know, and most of us, many of us would be like, I'm good, I don't want to chew gum, and the species would die, you know.
Right.
But what we're discovering is it's the overuse of dopamine that leads to addiction. So dopamine begins to shrink in our brain when we use pornography compulsively or engage in a behavior that's addictive. And then the reward center in our brain is in a state of dopamine craving. And it's as, in that state, it's as if we've now reset the pleasure thermostat in our brain, right? We need more drugs. And in the case of pornography, more perverted forms of it,
right,
in order to boost the dopamine levels up enough to feel normal. Now, I'll just finish by saying this because I know this is a lot of information. But in 2014, there was a study that came out of the Max Planck Institute for Human Development in Germany. And they were able to show that people who used pornography even moderately, that this led to volume loss in the brain. So these people weren't, you know, self-identified porn addicts. These were just people who used pornography to varying degrees. And they found, you know, literally brain shrinkage in different areas of the brain. Now, their hypothesis is that, yes, this is a causal relation, right? Porn is leading to this. In fact, the subtitle of their study is The Brain on Porn. But in the abstract, they said, if we're wrong and it's not a matter of causation, it would just follow that it's a matter of correlation, which essentially means if porn isn't shrinking your brain, then it follows that people with smaller brains like porn more. And either way, it's not a feather in your cap, you know. But there is hope, right? We have this thing that we now know called neuroplasticity, which basically means that the brain changes itself based on the behaviors that we engage in. And so just like, you know, behaving in the sense of acting and consuming pornography can have a negative, deleterious effect on the brain, recovery, time in recovery, detox, you know, 12-step groups, therapy, whatever, you know, choosing right behaviors can actually have a restorative effect on the brain.
Right. So one of the things I like to get into is, you know, you mentioned the different levels and it becomes the point where you want more, you crave more, you will crave more. How do people turn it off? And we talked about, you know, children stopping kids from being exposed to it. But if someone is exposed to it, they're within its clutches and they can't find ways to break out on their own. Obviously, they can't do it on their own. That's one thing. How can they break free?
Just as we're speaking, I'm thinking of an analogy, and I haven't ever used it before, so it might fall flat. So let's see. Suppose there was a small fire in your house, right? Maybe you've lit a candle for prayer or something, and it catches some painting on fire or something, you know? Mm-hmm. At that point, there are certain things that you might engage in. You know, you might get a towel from the kitchen and beat it, you know, or you might whatever. Mm-hmm. But if it was a much more serious fire, much more serious remedies would be needed, like calling the fire brigade or something, or mm-hmm. waking up your children and bring them out of the house. So the point in using that analogy is I think that there are short-term, simple things one can do, and then there are sort of call the fire brigade things we should do. So those small things we should do are really obvious and we have to be doing them. It's things like being accountable. All right. That's like getting the tea towel,
right.
Swapping the fire. If you're not doing that, what are you doing? You know, it's like mm-hmm. It's like wanting to run a marathon without exercising, eating properly, or buying sneakers. It's like, just admit you don't want to be free of porn. If you're not willing to pay for accountability and filtering software, just seriously question whether or not you actually want to be free. That's mm-hmm. an obvious thing that you should be doing. Going to confession when one falls, these sorts of things. Becoming aware of one's triggers, right? These are sort of the obvious things. Now, the kind of, you know, but what if you've heard all this sort of stuff before? You know, like move the computer into a high trafficked area, mm-hmm. get rid of your smartphone, etc. Well, then you have to take more drastic responses. And I think most people probably are at this point, even though they don't realize it or would like to admit it. And I think those three things, the three things that we see people do to get the most success are an SA group, a therapist, and a spiritual director. That when we've seen people use these three things in unison, we see the most sobriety result. Mm-hmm. So going to SA.org, Sexaholics Anonymous, right? You can find a meeting in your area, right? Mm-hmm. And attend it, right? And sometimes people say, well, what if people see me there? And you're like, well, if they see you there, it's because they're there as well. So you'll be okay. Just go, you know?
Good point.
Yeah, and what is SA? I mean, it's essentially sitting before people who care about you. And who are listening to your story and your pain and who love you, you know, that's really important. Don't overlook that. You can even do phone meetings. They have that on SA.org if you're not yet willing to walk into a room, but obviously ideally it would be to go to a meeting in your area. Number two would be to find a certified sex addiction therapist. Now, if your only options are Catholic therapist or non-Catholic therapist who's certified in sex addiction, I'd recommend going to the non-Catholic. I think it's more important that one be certified in sex addiction therapy than to go to a Catholic who isn't. obviously the best result will be to have both. Mm-hmm. But if people were looking for a therapist in their area who's been certified, they could go to our website, integrityrestored.com, and under getting help, they can click find a therapist and punch in their postal code to find someone. And then finding a spiritual director who can kind of help a person with, you know, their image of God and their view of God's image of them and so forth. But it seems to me that many times people aren't willing to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, they make all sorts of excuses for why they're not that far gone, why they can handle it, or they just whine and complain about why it's so difficult. But when you say, well, do you have accountability software on your phone? They'll be like, well, I did, but it kind of, it was annoying. And I'm like, well, shut up. Like, you need to man up here and make a decision, you know, because you can look at porn if you want. Like, that's an option. You can do it, you know, or you cannot. And if you don't want to, which I certainly advise, then there's certain things that, that you can begin doing. Just very finally, I'd say, I don't think it's helpful to view recovery from pornography as an all or nothing affair. If one is addicted to pornography and decides to try and stop, relapses are going to happen. But I think what's important is that we learn from those relapses. We have the humility to stand up and to continue walking the walk, because the only other option, right, is to kind of get sucked into the whirlpool that the porn industry perhaps wants us in.
Yeah, and again, we mentioned it earlier, but they're definitely out there with their claws trying to get at us. And, you know, we've come so far, as we mentioned earlier, from the 1950s Playboys, where they had to mix in how to be a good gentleman, and today to the freakish stuff that's out there. We're gonna take a break here, and we'll be right back to get some closing thoughts in the last segment. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic book blogger. We're with Matt Frad today, talking about his book, The Porn Myth, from Ignatius Press, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger, and today we're going to talk about an epidemic. Back when I was growing up, we had Ronald Reagan and his war on drugs, and I remember being in school and the frequent talks about how bad drugs were and the effects of their use. Of course, all of that was true, and it still is today, but frankly, we have a new drug that has slowly worked its way into our society. It's very easy to get hold of, and anyone with an internet connection has access to it. In fact, you can even get it in your pocket from your phone, and I'm talking about pornography. Today I have someone on the show who is on the front lines educating people about and fighting against the dangers of porn. Matt Frad is the founder and executive director of The Porn Effect, a website dedicated to exposing the reality behind the fantasy of porn and offering help. He also serves as director of content development for Integrity Restored. He speaks to about 50,000 people every year on the harmful effects of pornography and how to free them from it. He's the author of several books, including Delivered, True Stories of Men and Women Who Turned from Porn to Purity, and his most recent book from Ignatius Press, The Porn Myth, Exposing the Reality Behind the Fantasy of Porn. Welcome to the show, Matt Frad.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you here. So before we get into the new book, which is a real eye-opener, by the way, how did you get involved in your ministry?
Accidentally. several years ago, a couple of years into my marriage, I myself began to experience significant degree of healing from the wounds pornography inflicted upon me as a younger boy. And being quite excited about the freedom I was experiencing, I just began speaking about it wherever I could and to whoever I could. And certainly back then, that was about 10 years ago, there wasn't too many people talking about it. Mm-hmm. Certainly there were, but not a lot. So, it gained some attention. I since then, you know, went on to study philosophy and did apologetic work and that sort of thing. But I can't help. I seem to keep coming back to the topic of pornography. It's one, I think, you know, if you think of in the broad thing of evangelization, I think pornography is perhaps one of the greatest impediments in today's day and age. So that's why I'm passionate about talking about it. Not only its effects, but why I think it's actually intrinsically evil. That is, not just evil because of what it does, but because of what it is.
Right, right. So people understand what your approach is in your new book. Again, it's from Ignatius Press, The Porn Myth, Exposing the Reality Behind a Fantasy of Pornography. It's not an overtly religious book. And the reason I bring that up is, readers shouldn't let that be a misconception that scares them away, because pornography affects anyone, and your book is basically aimed at everyone, not one particular religious sect or group of people, correct?
That's right. It's actually not religious in any sense of the word, or depending on your definition of religious, I suppose. But I don't mention Christ or sin or confession or redemption or anything like that, as important as those things clearly are. But I think that just like we can all recognize that a book that just provides science and logic as to why, you know, abortion ends the life of an innocent human being, we can do something similar with pornography. And I think in a secular culture, it can be a real help to begin to phrase the conversation in a way that people will accept and perhaps go from there.
Right, right. So basically I want to take the rest of the show and drill down through the book and start at the top level. And that's what I think is really nice about how you have the book laid out, is you progress through the book and you start at a 10,000 foot view, and you look at porn at the overall effect. And you start with what you call in the first chapter, the porn culture. Now, many people think of porn in its extreme, but you also point out that there are different levels of porn, so to speak. I mean, you know, when men subscribe to their annual Sports Illustrated subscription and the swimsuit issue comes in the mail, that's in essence soft porn, especially nowadays when they're really not wearing clothing, they're painting the bikinis on. So can you tell us a little bit about the porn culture and why it's important to start there with the discussion?
Yeah, so I think, it's important that we define our terms. You know, if we want to discuss what pornography is or what constitutes pornography, we should probably know what we're talking about. And, you know, the rough definition I suggest is material that depicts erotic behavior, which is intended to sexually arouse. And so with that definition in mind, if you think that's reasonable, you can then begin to run things through that filter. You know, you could say, is 50 Shades of Stupid, however poorly written, sexually explicit material intended to sexually arouse? And yeah, it is. You know, what about the Victoria's Secret fashion show? And I'm not pretending it's always black and white. I think there's going to be elements where we're really not sure. Perhaps the positives outweigh the negatives, such as in a particular TV series or a movie in which there might be pornographic elements. But I think that's a basic definition that I think is helpful. And I think that since the advent of the internet, pornography has clearly become, as you mentioned in your intro, accessible, affordable, and anonymous in a way that it has never been before. And, you know, when you think of the following things, right, think of like alcohol, gambling, marijuana, pornography. One of these is a lot cheaper than the rest. In fact, one of them is free. So because of that, pornography use has skyrocketed, right? There's very few telltale signs, at least immediately, as to whether or not you've been engaging in this particular behavior. You know, you don't smell it on the breath. There's no needle marks. You know, your account balance isn't depleted necessarily. And so for that reason, it seems to have all the advantages and none of the setbacks. And I think many people in our culture are being exposed and becoming addicted to pornography at a young age, and that necessarily affects the culture at large.
Right, right, definitely. And one of the things that popped up a few months back in November, you were at the Integrity Restored Conference in Pennsylvania, and I was in attendance. And one of the things that struck me that a lot of the people talked about, again, goes back to that accessibility. I mean, we've taken, and you said it yourself in your talk, we've taken computers and boiled them down to a 3x5-inch smartphone, and kids have these. It's a necessity today. So kids have access to it once they figure out where to find it.
Yeah, so I think I see what you mean, you know, in that we consider it to be a necessity, but it's nice to step back and remind ourselves that it's
not.
Really isn't. And it's far more, you know, there's other detrimental effects to being constantly glued to your phone that don't have to do with pornography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's constantly distracting. It might deplete one's ability to concentrate in a way that, you know, might be irreversible unless something intervenes, you know,
right.
Social media and so forth. And so for that reason, I think any parents listening shouldn't be fooled into thinking that they need to get their children a smartphone. I think they'd be a lot better off without it for as long as they can, as long as you can hold it off.
Yeah. So in essence, when parents are fooled into that because society is telling us, you know, you need it, they're in essence putting a complete library of pornography in their hands if their child so chooses to find it.
Right, yeah. Father Sean Kulkoli put it this way. He said it's a portable X-rated movie theater.
That's a good point.
And that's strong language, and it's meant to be strong language, right? It's meant to sort of wake us up a little.
Right. So next in the book, you go down and look at the porn industry itself. And there's a lot to take in here in that chapter. One point that I think needs to be made is about the actors, and in particular the women actors. I mean, people who consume pornography obviously are looking at this as a fantasy realm, but there's real people on the other end of it. And the women coming out of the industry actually reveal horror stories of how they're treated.
Right. Yeah, I mean, does any sober person really think that these people are living a fairy tale life? I think for the most part, it's not that these actors are there by choice, but because of a lack of choice, right? Mm-hmm. That they end up in there. And very often when they leave the industry, they begin sharing things that they wouldn't have shared while they were trying to build up their, you know, online persona and website and so forth. And so there's many examples of this. It's actually quite boring. It's predictable. You know, you've got Pamela Anderson, Jenna Jameson, Bella Knox from Duke University, you know, talking about prior abuse in their life and so forth. And it's just not glamorous. I mean, just ask yourself the question, you know, if you encountered a 10-year-old girl who said when she grows up she'd like to be a porn performer, I don't think anyone, you know, worth their soul would say, yeah, that's really healthy. That's really good. That could be a really healthy choice. No, I think we would all recognize something terrible has happened in this girl's life. And the idea that, well, when she becomes 18, that somehow magically it's different, I think is a naive position that we willingly adopt if we want to look at digital prostitutes.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I guess the big question here underlying all of this is, how in the world did we get here? I mean, how did it develop to this point in our society that it's acceptable, basically?
Yeah, I mean, that's a long story, and we can look at it at different levels. You know, we could look at it from the culture's willingness to accept, you know, sexualization to one degree or another. We could talk about people like Hugh Hefner and how Playboy would certainly not have survived back in the 50s if it hadn't have been interwoven with articles about how to be a quote-unquote gentleman and how to, you know, host a cocktail party and these sorts of things. It would have died. It's almost like we had to take the poison a little bit by a little bit. I think we definitely do not live in a Christian culture right today. It's a post-Christian culture, and it's one that doesn't necessarily believe actually in the dignity of the human person. I mean, we might talk about it, we might like to be treated in a way that makes us feel good and that and so on, but we don't really believe it. And so if all we are is a sort of walking collection of atoms, then maybe there isn't anything wrong with sexually exploiting the person or degrading them. In fact, what the heck does degrade even mean? I mean, when you say you've degraded someone, you're presupposing they had a grade to begin with. But, you know, if we're just sort of matter bumping around, then we're really not degrading anybody by consuming pornography or whatever.
So we'll come back on that thought, and we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Pete Socks, the book blogger, and my guest, Matt Fratt. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Socks, a Catholic book blogger. We're here today with Matt Fratt, and we're talking about his new book from Ignatius Press, The Porn Myth, Exposing the Reality Behind the Fantasy of Pornography. And Matt, before we get too much further, I do want to point out to listeners that the book itself, all the royalties are going to a group called the Children of the Immaculate Heart, a nonprofit co-op in San Diego. Can you tell us a little bit about what that co-op's all about?
Yeah, so they house women and children who have been, sex slaves, essentially. Mm-hmm. And once they're kind of out, they house them and sort of equip them with skills perhaps necessary to kind of live outside of the homes. They get them therapy and these sorts of things. They're an incredible group, Children of the Immaculate Heart. So, yeah, if people want to buy the book, which I think they should, mm-hmm. they'll not only kind of educate themselves to respond to a pornified culture, they'll be supporting this group in getting the book too.
Excellent. So as we dive deeper into the book, you also talk about the individual, and obviously that's a key point here in the whole epidemic of pornography, and that's the individual that is using pornography as an escape. And you know, this is another thing that came up at the Integrity Restored event that never crossed my mind. Society, I think, up to now, has always looked at pornography as being a male thing. But that's not the case. There's women that are just as heavily using it and harmed by the use of pornography as males. Isn't that true?
That's certainly true. As you mentioned earlier, I speak to thousands of young adults, teenagers, older groups every year, and it's unfortunate, but there's still that idea that this is just a men's problem. Why would I want to speak to a mixed audience sort of thing? And without fail, I'm always chatting with girls afterwards, or, you know, who might thank me over Twitter or Instagram just to say, I thought I was the only one. Thank you for addressing this. Thank you for, you know, showing this isn't just a guy's issue. So, I mean, when you raise children with portable X-rated movie theaters, they get exposed at a young age. It's makes sense, right? That mm-hmm. little children who are interested and curious about sex and their bodies and other people's bodies might eventually get hooked on this sort of thing. So it's just not fair, and it's not true to say that women don't struggle with porn.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually detrimental to the whole process because you'd be ignoring the problems that they're having if we're looking at it that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, we keep bringing this up, and I was going to ask this later, but let's do it now. We have an epidemic in society. We know that kids have access and can get hooked at an early age. What can parents do to stop the bleeding? What can parents do to put a roadblock up and protect their kids from even being exposed to it? Now, obviously, they can't hover over them all day long. They go to school. Who knows what happens there? But at least what steps can a parent take to try and prevent this exposure to their children?
Yeah, so I think a number of things. You know, modeling a healthy view of the body and sexuality. Right. If the children see that mum and dad are comfortable with their bodies, they don't treat their bodies as if they're somehow bad or shameful. Right. I think using the anatomical names of vagina and penis, you know, mm-hmm. speaking to our children about the reality of their bodies and the goodness of their bodies. I think talking to our children about pornography from a very young age is necessary. You know, when we bring up the topic, it's not like we're imposing the thoughts that we think of when we hear the term pornography. You know, we're just sort of saying to our children, you know, if you see videos or pictures of people who are showing parts of their body that their bathing suit should cover, be sure to tell mum and dad, and we'd be really proud of you for doing that. So, yeah, you be the expert, because if we parents aren't willing to teach our children about porn, then the porn industry absolutely will. So there's no other option. And just like I shared, I mean, there's a way to do that in a way that isn't scandalous. Mm-hmm. So we have to give our children an internal filter for an unfiltered, internal filter for an unfiltered world.
Right.
And then we just have to. I get so frustrated when I encounter parents who don't have filters on their kids' phones.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a parent listening, yes, I'm frustrated with you, because my inbox is filled with like 12-year-olds and 14-year-olds who all want to tell their parents that they're addicted to porn because they don't know how to function. But they're terrified to talk to their parents about it. You know, it's funny. You wouldn't expect that, right? You'd expect all these naughty kids trying to get away with something. Well, they're not naughty kids. They've just been exposed to porn. It's become a problem. They're desperate for help, but they're so afraid to talk to their parents about it. So parents need to talk to their kids, and they need to install filters and accountability software on their children's devices. I sort of think if we as parents don't do that, then we'll be held accountable on Judgment Day for not protecting our children the way we should. So if parents discover that their children have been looking at porn, the first thing they should do isn't get angry. They should actually never get angry at their kids for looking at porn, although I understand that's a understandable reaction because we're horrified.
Right.
But instead, we should say sorry, because it's our fault, actually. It's not our kids' fault. It's our fault. We birthed them into this pornified culture. We gave them technology that can access pornography, which we didn't lock down.
Mm-hmm.
How hypocritical would it be for us to then get angry at our kids? Rather, what we need to do is say, look, please forgive me. I didn't protect you the way I should have, but things are going to be different now. And then go to covenanteyes.com, for example, and spend time on the site. Is it a pain in the butt to get filtering and accountability? Yeah, it is. But it's much more a pain in the butt to have a child who's addicted to hardcore violent pornography, who then needs to go to therapy and may have to live with the wounds inflicted upon him for, in some degree or another, for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If that sounds dramatic, I mean it to be. You know, I mean to be dramatic, because this is a really dramatic thing that's taking place in the lives of these young people.
You know, I think part of the problem from a parent's standpoint, I know you're a parent as well, Matt, is when if you first discover it, pornography is almost an embarrassing thing to talk about for most people, I think. I don't know if embarrassing is the word I want to use. Uncomfortable talking about it. And I think that's part of the reasons why parents shy away from discussing it. Do you see that when you encounter parents and they discuss it?
Yeah, I think people feel that way. I don't feel that way. I think that the pornography talk doesn't come out of the blue, right? It's like, mm-hmm. we've never talked about how God made us and our bodies and what it is when we get an erection, you know, as a young boy, or why, mm-hmm. you know, why we shouldn't, you know, touch ourselves like this and that and in the bathtub or whatever in an appropriate way. If we haven't had those conversations, then I agree that the porn conversation kind of comes out of the blue. But what if you have? Like, what if you've talked to your children about their penis and testicles and their vagina and why they should cover their belly, because that's the womb and that's really precious, mm-hmm. and we should veil what demands the reverence? What if we told our daughters, this is why your belly is more special than your brother's, and here's why? You know, if we have those sort of ongoing conversations, which are easy conversations to have at a young age, then I think it kind of makes sense to say, well, when people, you know, do show these parts of their body, it's kind of a sign to the world that they don't know how good they are, you know, and that's sort of sad. Mm-hmm. And so then when you say, if you see pictures of people showing their, you know, breasts or their vagina or penis, you know, you always tell mommy and daddy, it's not that shocking. And nor do we need to feel at such a young age that we in any way have to share, you know, the sorts of things we've been through. That would be imprudent and inappropriate, mm-hmm. to do that. So, yeah, maybe people are a little shy about it. They feel a little embarrassed about it, but they have two options: get over it or let the porn industry teach their kids about porn.
That's a good point. And I like how you constantly drive that home, even in your talks. Either we do something about it or the porn industry is going to, because that's flat out the truth. They've been, you know, the porn industry's been very creative in how they come about weaving their way into people's lives. I mean, you know, I talked about her. You can't even sit down and watch a football game without seeing a Victoria's Secret commercial. I mean, it's pathetic.
Right. And so back in the 90s, the conversation may have been, how do we make sure our kids aren't exposed to porn? That's no longer the conversation, because our children will see porn. You follow all the steps, you get all the right filters, you have all the right conversations, your children will see porn, my children will see porn. Unless we sort of blind them, they're going to. And that's why it's so important to keep these open lines of communication with our children, so that they should never feel afraid to come to us and tell us, you know, if they masturbated or looked at porn. They always know that mommy and daddy are going to love on them and sort of remind them of the goodness of the body and why we don't do that, and mm-hmm. and, you know, help them go to confession in a way that doesn't shame them. You know, because if we just freak out, like a lot of, you know, I think of my friends in high school, a lot of our parents freaked out. What do you do? It's not like you're like, oh, okay, mom, thanks for freaking out. Next time I look at this, I'll be sure to tell you. No, you'll never tell them again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk some more about what the effects of pornography really are on a person and different levels that we see. You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Pete Sox, the Catholic Book Blogger. We'll be back with more from Matt Fred. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic Book Blogger, here with Matt Fry today discussing his book, The Porn Myth, Exposing the Reality Behind the Fantasy of Pornography. We've discussed all kinds of things about it. In last segment, we were talking about how people can help themselves when they find themselves in the clutches of pornography. And Matt, you mentioned that the big thing is you either want to do it or you don't want to help yourself. But I think one of the things people need to realize is not only are they affecting themselves with this addiction, but it also has adverse effects on personal relationships with people. So can you go into that a little bit for us?
Sure. I mean, I mentioned dopamine in the previous segment, but let me use another analogy to kind of set up our discussion about how porn affects relationships. If you're on the phone with someone, perhaps your boss, and they're really angry for some reason and they start shouting at you, if you don't hang up, which, you know, let's be honest, you should, you might remove the phone away from your ear. Mm-hmm. Now, if your boss continues to shout, you'll be able to hear him somewhat, but if he stops shouting, you know, you won't be able to hear him unless you bring that phone quickly back up to your ear and pretend you knew what he was saying, you know. Well, it's like that when we consume pornography. When we open up the laptop lid or go to our phone and look at porn, our brain is being shouted at by dopamine. And what we're discovering is when we shut the laptop, when we turn the phone off and kind of re-enter reality, it's very difficult to hear, as it were, the pleasure and the meaning we used to hear from different activities. So whereas we used to like playing on the trampoline with our daughter or building Lego with our son or practicing an instrument or writing poetry or reading novels, all of a sudden, the whole world seems sepia-toned. We find ourselves to be very agitated and uninterested in anything other than pornography, because again, it's that which is going to boost that dopamine up. And so as a consequence, it's not just our romantic relationships that suffer, it's all of our relationships that suffer. I've said in the past, I've never met an addict who I found interesting or an addict who found me interesting. It's like, for the addict, his life becomes narrower and narrower, sepia-toned and boring, you know, frightfully boring. And so because of that, everyone around him or her suffers. Now, certainly we should say something about the spouses of those who suffer. Now, in my experience, while certainly both men and women can struggle with pornography, when women struggle with pornography and are married, they usually want to bring pornography into the bedroom and share the experience with their spouse during the marital embrace, right? Mm-hmm. But men aren't really like that. Men kind of want to view it on their own. So if you're thinking of a particular married couple where one of them has a problem with porn, it's almost always the husband. And you know, it's been really interesting to see the effects, and saddening to see the effects that this has on the wife. There was a recent study done. I mentioned it in my book for wives. It's called Restored, also published by Catholic Answers. They did a study where they were able to see that people who were married to men who were addicted to porn or sex exhibited similar behaviors and dysfunctions as those who had PTSD. So this is now a kind of, they call it betrayal trauma. This is a new term that therapists are using to sort of identify this constellation of ill effects. And thank God there's really good information out there available. One website would be bloomforwomen.org. That's bloom like a flower, bloomforwomen.org. And others that women can go to, because very often they'll say, what can I do about my husband? And, you know, I've learned to say, well, hang on, before we get to him, let's talk about you. What are you doing about you? Because you've also experienced tremendous trauma. I think if a woman is in a relationship with a husband who is not interested in getting help, then she should leave him. She is almost, I would say, morally obligated to leave a toxic environment with her children. Mm-hmm. And it isn't playing the hero or doing something holy to remain in a toxic environment, let's say with a man who's totally addicted to porn and uninterested in getting any kind of help. That's just, she shouldn't be in that situation. And so, you know, it's a crummy situation, but I know several women right now personally who've had to make that decision.
Mm. Incredible. So you've written this book. All the royalties are going to an organization, and you're not getting anything from it. What is your hope for this book, and why was it important for you to write it?
Yeah, well, I mean, full disclosure, Ignatius gave me some money to write the book. Mm-hmm. So I did get money to write it. You're right. I 100% of the royalties I no longer get. So, yeah, I don't make a cent. If you buy a book or not, it doesn't bother my financial bank account, you know, my mm-hmm. bank account at all. But I wanted to just write a book that showed a lot of the research that's coming out from sociology, psychology, and neurology. There's about 40 pages of bibliography in the back. A lot of it is from peer-reviewed studies and experts. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to kind of, you know, help people realize this isn't just a moral religious issue, although I think it is that. But it's also, it's just a human rights sort of issue. And you know, we can do a lot better than porn has to offer us. And I think education is the best way to go about it. So, you know, if I go into a university to talk, I'll usually begin by saying something like, I'm not here to tell you what to do. You can do whatever you want to do. I just think that it's prudent to have the most information at your disposal before engaging in a behavior that could have negative effects. And so the book kind of takes that soft sell approach where it's like, pornography is detrimental to individuals, relationships, and society. Here's why. If you're pro-love and pro-science, then my argument is you should be anti-porn. So mm-hmm. I hope the book, you know, leads people to, you know, reject porn and choose love.
Right. Definitely.
Instead.
Yeah. I mean, I experienced your speaking at, again, Integrity Restored in November of last year. You really drive the point home. I think what you do is fantastic work, Matt. One of the things that I caught a snippet of and didn't get a chance to read the whole thing was you actually testified before a state subcommittee. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I was going to here in Georgia, in order to make pornography a public health crisis by the Health and Human Services Committee. Unfortunately, we weren't heard that day, but we're hoping that it'll be brought up next session. And now, who knows, I might get to testify then.
That did actually occur in Virginia, I believe, where the subcommittee
Yeah, about four different states right now have declared pornography a public health crisis. I think Virginia called it a public health problem or something. Mm-hmm. There was some reason. I actually got to interview the senator in Utah who made porn a public health crisis and got the ball rolling. If people are interested, I have a podcast called Integrity Restored. Mm-hmm. So if they just go to iTunes or wherever they listen to their podcast, type in Integrity Restored or Matt Fratt or whatever, and they could listen to the interview that I had with him. And he explained some really exciting things coming down the pipeline.
Now, what's the importance of a state doing that? What's that do to help the situation?
So I think what it does is it just raises awareness. So if a state is going to declare something a public health crisis, mm-hmm. they're going to therefore, it gives legitimacy to the work I'm doing and other people are doing, right? So if I can go in and say, look, your state has recognized this after looking at the literature, after hearing testimonies, they've recognized this is a public health crisis. It gives legitimacy to that. And also, a state wouldn't make it a public health crisis unless they're then going to thereby back it up by, you know, somehow supporting the work of people who are trying to, say, filter Wi-Fi in public places and that sort of thing. The next step is, okay, put your money where your mouth is. But the public health crisis is like, well, saying it, and now it's up to us, the citizens, to challenge the state to walk the walk.
Mm-hmm. So
they're doing that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, here's one cool thing that's happened. The same senator who made pornography a public health crisis in Utah just passed a new bill. All right. So not just an announcement, but a bill. And it's going to make it so that if you've been negatively impacted by pornography, you can potentially sue porn companies.
Hmm.
Right. Now, just like this used to be the case, right, for tobacco, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could potentially sue Marlboro and whoever else. Well, you might think to yourself, yeah, but how likely is it that people will do that and be successful? Well, it might not be that likely, but here's the really cool part of the bill. They've made it so that any porn company can have a sort of escape clause. So if they do not want to be sued in the state of Utah, all they have to do is put a health warning before you enter the site. How cool is that? So you can start going to these sites and saying, just so you know, pornography has been known to lead to detrimental, you know, brain atrophy, sexual violence, marital breakdown, erectile dysfunction. Okay, click through to the site. Just like you have those sort of signs on cigarette boxes. So
right. It's,
you know, it's all a way of changing the conversation, mm-hmm. and that conversation is certainly being changed.
Okay. So as we wind down here, Matt, we're starting to run out of time. What other projects do you have forthcoming that you'd like listeners to know about?
Well, I just tell people to stay close to Integrity Restored. We're doing a lot of great work. We're doing men's intensives where we'll get like 20 men together for 4 days. There'll be, you know, 5 full-time therapists, priests to kind of kickstart their therapy. We're doing days for priests to better equip them to help their parishioners. We do symposiums throughout the country where we'll come in, me, a psychologist, a priest, and we'll run 2 days, one day for all the clergy, and the next day for sort of the general public, catechists. So we're just trying to get the word out there, and we're coming up with a DVD curriculum that's coming out later this year through Integrity Restored. So, yeah, that's a lot of good stuff's happening.
And everybody can find your work at where?
Yeah, so integrityrestored.com.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thanks so much for spending time with me today. It was a pleasure having you here and giving you an opportunity to talk to us about this epidemic of porn. Again, Matt's book is The Porn Myth, Exposing the Reality Behind the Fantasy of Pornography from Ignatius Press. Any closing thoughts?
No, that's it. Thank you very much for having me on and help me get the word out.
Awesome. Thanks, Matt. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.
Thank you. for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.